This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we have a conversation about the Cessna Sky Courier with the technical marketing specialist in Beech and Cessna aircraft products at Textron Aviation. We also hear about youth programs from the president of EAA Chapter 196. In the news, we look at how strategic moves by aerostructures maker Triumph are affecting the Boeing 747, the engines being considered for the B-52 fleet and the F-15EX, the crash of a Pakistani airliner, Delta Airlines MD-80 fleet retirement, and the U.S. Air Force drops the blanket height requirement for pilot candidates. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 606 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a CFI of the year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
Well, I was an expert. Hi, Max. I've been looking for new clients, and today I was trying to teach my cat how to fly. Good news is he landed perfectly the first time.
Yeah, they tend to do that. Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian.
Hey, folks. How are we? Sorry I missed last week, but I was a little under the weather. But looking forward to a well-rounded conversation this evening.
Well-rounded. Wow. I'm interested to see how that goes.
Round and round.
Round and round. With us also is Airplane Geeks reporter-at-large, Launchpad Marzari.
Greetings, everyone, and to all those within sound of my voice.
This episode, we have an interview that Launchpad pre-recorded with Martin Tuck from Textron Aviation. He's the technical marketing specialist in Beech and Cessna aircraft products. And coming up, you'll hear a very interesting conversation about the Cessna Sky Courier aircraft. But first, the news. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
Ready deep in the heart of.
All right, first item. This comes from a blog called Live and Let's Fly. And this is titled Boeing Debates Future of 747 Program. The Aerostructures subsidiary of Triumph Group is a longtime producer of fuselage and horizontal stabilizer panels for the 747. The problem is that Triumph announced that it will shut down two of the plants manufacturing those components. Now, Boeing has enough parts for the 747 backlog, but that's the end of the supply. So if they were going to continue production, Boeing would have to find a new source. Now, Flight Global reports that Boeing has internally decided that it needs at least 100 additional orders for this to be worthwhile, for them to go out and qualify another source, get them geared up. But this sounds like the complete end of the 747 to me. What do you guys think?
Boy, they've got to decide in the next 2 years. If the economy were roaring along, I would say, yeah, pretty good chance they might extend it. But man, right now, I just can't imagine that there are going to be enough new orders. I mean, is the economy going to be able to rebound enough in 2 years for people to decide, yeah, we want to add to our fleet?
Well, there might be a lot of freighters out there that could be used. You know, where it seems like cargo is the only thing going on. But, you know, if we ground the A380 fleet and that suddenly becomes cargo transports, definitely Boeing is going to be out of the 747 business.
I concur, because the only advantage a 747 would have would be outsized cargo. And as we've seen, because the nose loading door of a 747, when it's the cargo version with the opening clamdale north, is still not as big as it needs to be as the Antonovs or anybody else to haul outsized cargo. So at that point, you're just moving pallets around, and you can move two jets worth of pallets for a 747 and probably the same amount of fuel.
Now, UPS has been building its fleet of 747-8F freighters. They're planning to build the fleet up to 28 of them, and they've got 13 more to be delivered. And this sort of maps out the timeline for that aircraft. Boeing produces one of those every 2 months, so it's a pretty slow production rate. But the Triumph Group, I was really surprised to take a look at what those guys are doing. So they've been in the middle of a aerospace structures strategic review. And from their press release on this from a few days ago, in April 2019, Triumph announced that it was undertaking this comprehensive review of its structures business to focus on core systems and product support markets and capabilities. So this is a little bit different. Now, it says that Triumph has divested its 10 build-to-print machine shops, 5 fabrication shops, 2 metal finishing facilities, and its 2 million square foot Nashville large structures plant. It says earlier this year, as this blog post states, Triumph completed its final 747 fuselage panels in its Hawthorne, California factory, which is planned to be closed later this calendar year, that being 2020. It says the transition of its Boeing 767 structural assembly work out of its Grand Prairie, Texas plant is nearing completion, in anticipation of concluding all production activities in early calendar year 2021. Over 1 million annual hours of structures work has been outsourced. And in recent weeks, they say they've reached agreement in principle to sell its G650 and G700 wing business to Gulfstream. They've secured purchase orders from Boeing commercial airplanes across multiple programs to maintain certain economical production levels. But they've also reached an agreement with Israeli Aviation Industries to accelerate the transfer of the G280 wing program to IAI and Korean Aerospace Industries by July of this year. And also taken together, they say the company's comprehensive de-risking actions will reduce the number of aerospace structures sites. Now get this. From 34 to 9, reduce occupied space by 4.4 million square feet, and reduce staffing levels by over 4,000 employees. So Triumph Group is one of the major aerostructures manufacturers, and they're moving on to other business focus. So that's going to have a fairly large impact, I think.
Well, gee, that was happy news coming from an unexpected place, he says sarcastically.
Yeah. So this Live and Let's Fly blog, it was something I hadn't encountered before. It's written by Matthew Clint, who he says travels more than 200,000 air miles each year. He works in the aviation industry and as a travel consultant. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Check that out, the Live and Let's Fly blog.
Well, I'm kind of wondering, do you think there's any chance that Spirit AeroSystems out of Wichita could pick up the slack? I mean, they already produce a lot of structures for Boeing. I know there have been a lot of layoffs in Wichita lately. Just seems to me like that might be a logical place to look to get some assistance on this.
That's a good point, because I think the number of employees that they've laid off maps pretty well to the Triumph workforce reduction. And Spirit is kind of one of the other big aerostructures companies. Maybe Wichita stands to benefit from this.
Well, and they've had such a big downturn, I'm sure they would, be delighted. And I'm guessing there must be some more industrial space that they could expand into to do this out there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's a good point. All right, big engine news with the United States Air Force. First, from Defense News, we see U.S. Air Force launches contest to replace the B-52 bomber's engine. Oh, yet again, we We see the Air Force looking to replace the engines on its, I think, David, what, 76 B-52s. And yep. They've sent RFPs out to Pratt & Whitney, to GE, and Rolls-Royce. Now, as you may or may not know, each B-52H has 8 Pratt & Whitney TF-33 engines. And these are designs that go back to, like, the 1950s.
When jet engines were pretty inefficient.
Quite, right.
The H was the most efficient because it was a turbofan and not a turbojet.
Exactly. And that TF-33, it's the military designation for the JT-3 commercial engine, which powered the Douglas DC-8 and the Boeing 707. So that's what you're looking at flying on B-52s. And that bomber has 4 pylons. Each has a pair of those TF-33s. And, yeah, like you guys are pointing out, they're loud, they're smoky, they get terrible fuel burn. And, oh, did I say they were designed like in the 1950s?
And they're so beautiful.
Yeah. Well, and to our, you know, our air geeks who aren't that, you're thinking, well, they might get, you know, like if you remember back at Dale Brown and the Flight of the Old Dog, they're not looking to put brand new turbofans on. Let me back up before I say that. Big turbofans. The RFP clearly looking for 8 engines, because to put single engines would require pylon redesigns. It would require how the wings mount to the pylon, or the pylons mount to the wings, and then a complete cockpit redesign. It would just, so they're actually asking for 8 engines. And think, you know, not to, Max Flight can give us much more details, but think of, these are the engines that are like on the back of big business jets.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about those in just a second. First, it might be worth mentioning that previous, I don't even want to use the word plans, but in some cases plans, in some cases proposals or ideas to re-engine the B-52s did include going with 4 larger engines. At one point, they were looking at 4 Pratt & Whitney PW2000 engines, or the military designation, F-117, which is what you find basically on the Boeing 757 and on the C-17s. At one point, there was a proposal for 4 leased Rolls-Royce RB211 engines. That didn't go. There was a competition at one point proposed between that RB211, the PW2000, and also the CFM56 engines, which is what's on the Boeing 737s and some other things. But now what we're looking at, it's called the Commercial Engine Reengineering Program. A little redundant there. The Commercial Engine Reengineering Program, CERP, or I guess we call that SERP.
Well, it's kind of funny because we've got now a commercial space program. This is a commercial reengineering. One of the things we've talked about recently, especially with military aviation, is using off-the-shelf components for whatever the need is, and not creating a specific mission-specific, platform-specific engine or electronics, but using what's out there to do that. So that's really where we're going with this. And like Brad said, the engine pylons and the structure, they want to keep as simple as possible. And this has been kind of a trend in, believe it or not, the Warbird circuit. The recreated ME-262s that were replicas have the nacelles built for the Jumo engines from World War II, but have more modern engines hidden underneath them. So you're getting the same look, and you're getting the same thrust ratios, etc., but you have a more powerful, much better engine. So they're looking to keep the eight engines for balance, and for if you lose one on takeoff, etc. So Max, take it away with what are our choices. Envelope, please.
Yeah, from General Electric, well, there's actually 2 possibilities, but one is the TF-34, which, as Launchpad said, is popular on many biz jets, It's also a variant of that is what powers the A-10, actually. So that's one possibility. And that's an engine that's been around for, you know, for a while. It's very reliable. It's a good engine. Another possibility from GE is what they call their Passport engine, which is a newer design that GE is working on for regional and business jets. So that's from General Electric. From Pratt & Whitney, there's the PW800 series, which is also an engine for regional jets and business jets, which is produced by Pratt & Whitney Canada. And it actually has a common core with the geared turbofan engine, except it doesn't have the big high bypass fan and it doesn't have the gear. But the core of the Pratt & Whitney PW800 series engine is the same as the geared turbofan. And then from Rolls-Royce, we have the F-130, which is the military designation for the commercial BR-700 series, which is another business jet engine. So these are smaller diameter than the high bypass turbofans you see on 737s, 320 family series, and all of the others. Smaller diameter, but it turns out not a whole lot different from those TF-33 engines that are stuffed into the B-52s.
Well, as our insider into the engine world and our ringer, where do we put our money on the bet?
Oh,
come
gosh,
on. No. Come on, pick a winner.
No, so the Air Force will have a relatively complicated or complex system for evaluating the proposals, which will take into account a number of different factors. In this case, some of those factors will include things like fuel burn, because a more efficient engine requires less aerial refueling. That's a good thing. It'll include things like maintenance costs. What are the life cycle maintenance costs? A variety of different other aspects to it. I don't know if engine maintenance proposals or plans are going to be associated with these or not, or if it's, you know, the maintenance is going to continue as it has with the TF-33 in terms of who's doing it. I don't know. But it'll be an interesting process. This is actually the second phase of this proposal process. The three of them in the first phase, if you want to call it that, created digital prototypes. This was very interesting. I don't know if this has been done to this degree in the past, but the first round submission from the three engine makers was a digital prototype submission. But the final proposals, this comes up really fast. July 22nd is the deadline for the Air Force, the government, to receive the final proposals.
Which means the betting window is closing. Come on, pick. I'm going to hold you to this. Pick a winner here.
No.
You're the subject matter expert.
Yeah, but I don't. There's no way. I don't know. So factors, you know, I don't know if Rolls-Royce is at a disadvantage because it's not a U.S. supplier.
No, but they have. But the Air Force has got the E-11 and the C-37, which is the Bombardier A jet already. Of the three engines, the one that's in U.S. Air Force service is that engine.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Interesting.
And I saw in a press release where Rolls-Royce already came out yesterday and announced where in America those engines would be made. Let me see if I can find that again while you're talking among yourselves.
Yeah, that would be a lesson that Airbus has, you know, learned and leveraged if it's U.S. jobs. And a lot of times there's some politics that can enter into it as well. Support from Congress, which means, you know, what congressional districts. These proposals tend to be very complex and include a lot of different factors. But they are all evaluated under a stated formula, if you will, or method for calculating the winner of a competition like this.
So I'm curious, the first B-52 entered service back in 1955. They built a total of 744 of them. They're down now to 76. I would have thought, and maybe you know, you covered this, but it wasn't quite clear to me. Has it ever been re-engined before? You talked about all the different proposals, but are they still running on the original engines? I can't believe that.
The H model, which is all we have left, was the only ones to get TF-33s, which was the turbofan. The rest of them were, Max, help me.
Yeah, were earlier variants, you know, of that engine. The power increased over the years. You know, there were design changes made.
One of the things I think is interesting based on this article is it says they plan on ordering 608 new engines. And if you divide that by 76 B-52s, that actually works out to be 8. And you're like, which B-52 isn't getting new engines? Because there's got to be spares.
Yeah, you need spares. Yeah, interesting. All right, another re-engining, if you will. This comes from Flight Global. U.S. Air Force cancels GE Aviation sole source for F-15EX engine, asks for competitive bids. So the U.S. Air Force initially said that engines for the Boeing F-15EX would be sole sourced to GE Aviation, that for 480 F-110 jet engines. But Pratt & Whitney pushed back, I guess, said, what about us? So now the Air Force is asking GE and Pratt & Whitney for engine proposals. But first, David, what is a Boeing F-15EX?
That is the latest version of the Boeing or the McDonnell Douglas F-15. Everybody in the United States Air Force, we have the F-15E, which was the Strike Eagle, which was the multi-role version of the F-15. And originally, the F-15 had a sole source engine, which was the Pratt & Whitney F-100. Interestingly enough, that what happened was with the F-16, they came out with a dual source engine where they had GE engines and Pratt Whitney engines. Now, ironically, the F-15 was designed for multiple engine use. So the Pratt Whitney engine has sort of, he's going to yell at me, fall into the wayside because it's not necessarily the preferred engine for the Air Force, especially with the F-16s. They prefer the GE engines over the Pratt Whitney engines. Ironically, it's why the Thunderbirds have really nice, shiny Pratt Whitney engine aircraft, because the mainline units want the General Electric engines. But that being said, we have started to export F-15s with the GE engines. Singapore was one of the first air forces to get it. And the F-15SA, which is Saudi Arabia, also has the Pratt Whitney engines aboard them. So when the Air Force came aboard to purchase the F-15s to supplement our current F-15 fleet, which is long in the tooth, although after saying that B-52s are 50 plus years old, the F-15s, which started flying in 1970s and went in 1974, they're getting old in the tooth also. I mean, all of our F-15Cs. So they are looking to supplement them with F-15EXs, which is a multi-role combat aircraft based on the F-15SA, the Saudi Arabian one. And originally the plan was to have those equipped with Pratt Whitney engines. So, General Electric engines. So the Pratt Whitney motors, I guess they've decided that they need to bring them back into the mix. It does kind of make sense because currently all the F-15s in the U.S. service are Pratt & Whitney motors. So I can understand why they would want that commonality, but they were trying to streamline the line. So what's coming off the line right now is the General Electric motors. So I guess we'll see. We've got six of them on order. We'll see what motors they put into them.
It will be interesting. I don't know what the timeline is for the proposals or the decisions on this one. If it mentioned it in the Flight Global article, I missed it. Apologize for that. Yeah, so engine competitions are always Always interesting, to say the least. All right, a commercial story that has an engine component as well, in a very strange and unusual way, is reported in AvWeb. This is an incident, an accident that happened a little while ago. The Pakistan airliner landed gear up on first try. And this was, of course, the Pakistan International Airlines flight PK-8303. And, Max, they tried to land it with the gear up.
Well, there was a lot wrong with that particular flight. I've looked at some other articles as well, and they say that air traffic control was rather unnerved by the approach of this aircraft anyway, because apparently they were descending at a very high rate. Here's the thing that I find most amazing. They crossed the fence at the airport on their first approach at about 200 knots in an A320. Normal approach speed would be somewhere between maybe 130 and 140 knots. The idea of any aircraft being 60 to 70 knots fast on short final when you're landing, it just gives me the willies. Mm. I mean, no aircraft is going to land without huge amounts of runway. So there was clearly, in my mind, something very dysfunctional going on with this crew. For them to have ended up kind of slamming this thing in, descending very rapidly, coming in over ridiculously fast, and then forgetting to put down the landing gear. The first thing about this story that really caught my attention, that something was unusual about it, were the early reports that said that on this initial go around, that the aircraft actually scraped the runway three times. So apparently the engine nacelles, ground along the runway, and that must have been the clue to the crew that, oh, maybe something isn't right. And then they did the right thing, which was to, I'm not sure it was the right thing as I think about it, but they chose to go around, which is commonly the best strategy when you have a screw up like this. And then they flew for a couple minutes to try and get back around the pattern. And then somehow, apparently, both engines quit, which, as we all know, is pretty unusual. Usually you only have one engine quit at a time. When something like that happens, usually it's some common factor like fuel flow problem or something like that. But you can only wonder what kind of damage was done to those engines as they bounced off the runway and were scraped along three times at 200 knots. I think that, and then the last thing, of course, was that the pictures of the wreckage were just horrendous. This plane came down in a city neighborhood, and I have never seen a street that was so completely full of just burned up airplane parts. I mean, it was piled more than a story high, and it extended, for some way down a couple blocks. It was a horrific, horrific ending. Surprisingly, two out of the 97 people on board survived. They are just now reviewing the black box data in France. Hopefully it's going to tell us something, but I think what we know already is that this was a very unstable approach to begin with, and that unfortunately unstable approaches are good predictors for accidents.
I think the accident's going to be broken down to two parts. One is the before touchdown and all the bad decisions and broken procedures that got us to touchdown. But then at touchdown, when you start crushing engine nacelles into turning fan blades, the engines are just, I don't remember how long. I thought it was shorter than a minute that the engines were producing thrust, which is why I want to see the black box, because I think at that point they were just going on inertia, because the runway pitchers, they dug grooves in the runway.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
At that point, you're flying on pure inertia. I don't think the engines were developing any thrust, or they were just developing thrust by passing engine parts out the back.
Yeah. And there are some strange sort of aspects to this. There's one report from AeroTime that said the first responders, the investigators at the crash site found cash, like a lot of cash, $400,000 worth of cash in two bags. It wasn't in dollars. It was actually 30 million Indian rupees. roughly $400,000. And so people are, it's probably not related to the, you know, the whole thing, but people are wondering how these bags of cash got through, you know, the security checks and
how do you know they weren't at the rug stall that the airplane crashed into?
Could have been. Yeah. And actually it wasn't all in rupees. It was in different currencies. So there's an investigation into that. I also just saw today that there was one more death, that a 12-year-old girl on the ground who had, as a result of this crash, received burns on 60% of her body. It just passed away today. So we have that, unfortunate victim, innocent victim. But, yeah, this... So many times when there's an aviation accident, you know, we always speculate because it's impossible. It's really hard not to. But nevertheless, we're always saying, well, let's wait and see for the facts to come out and all that. And there certainly are a lot of facts that still have to come out. But this just – the whole thing just seems so crazy compared to, to most other accidents. I don't know what was going on in that cockpit with those folks, but the black boxes ought to tell us a lot.
I think the key takeaway for anybody listening to this is anytime you have an unstable approach where either your airspeed is too high, your descent rate is too high, you're off the center line, you're way off the glide slope, you know, any of these factors, just go around. It is the cheapest insurance. It saves lives. And you know, this is a classic example of what kind of problems you can have if you have an unstable approach.
And go around before impact.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Highly advised. All right. From Business Insider, we see Delta Airlines will be the last U.S. passenger airline to retire its MD-80 fleet in June. And they have mostly MD-88s, a few MD-90s. In their fleet, and that's a pull-up of the retirement, although I guess that's not surprising given the conditions, the situation that the airlines are in right now. The McDonnell Douglas MD-80 series, that was a successor to the smaller Douglas DC-9. The MD-80 offered better range, longer fuselage, more passengers. They had different cockpit improvements, as well as engine improvements. But that goes back a ways, too. Talk about planes that have been around for a while. First flight was in October 1979.
Yeah, wild. That's why it was called an 80.
Yes.
1980.
Yep. Yeah, I think 80 was the first delivery, was it, to Swiss or somebody, I think?
Swiss Air, yeah.
Swiss, yeah. Yeah.
See, folks, I do know airliners, believe it or not.
I'm surprised. Very good, David.
Well, okay. Let's be honest. A Mad Dog is really just a tube attached to two A4 Skyhawk engines. And I'm going to continue to think of it that way for the rest of my life.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Can I say that I won't miss the MD-80? Having sat in the back of those a couple of times, oh my goodness, they are so noisy in the back
because you've got those
engines right up against the fuselage as opposed to where they are supposed to be, you know, out there under the wings like you might find on a 737 or something like that. I have always, when I've been on one of those airplanes, try to avoid sitting in the back. But I also always travel with earplugs.
Yes, yeah.
And to add in insult to injury is when you're sitting in the back, you have a window seat, and you get a window view of the engine nacelle.
Yeah, you can't see anything in the back. Yeah. Yeah, sitting in the back of that plane is not the desired location for sure. Yeah, so that's that for the MD-80s, MD-90s.
And Captain Jeff had his last flight in the MD-88, I think, actually to PHL. So congratulations to our fellow podcaster and as he moves on to another airframe.
All right. Let's see. Also, just a quick note, back to the Thunderbirds. I mentioned them earlier from the drive. The Air Force Thunderbirds say they are done with America Strong flyovers. And Thunderbird said had posted a message on social media that their recent flight over Southern California would be the last of the America's Strong flyovers. I don't know. They kind of intimate in the article, David, that this might be have been a change in plans, that some people expected them to do some flights over the Pacific Northwest and some other places.
I think the three jet teams got tired. Formation flying is not easy. Formation flying for multiple hours over consistent days was a lot of strain put on the pilots. And with the loss of the Snowbird and the near miss that the Thunderbirds had over Los Angeles, I think all three teams needed to stand down. I think they were just overly taxed.
And what was the near miss?
The Thunderbirds had a near miss flying over Los Angeles where Thunderbird 1, they were flying in the Delta, and Thunderbird 1 was starting to do a bank to the left and did a quick reverse. And then number 6 and number 5 had to break out of the Delta for a no-joy call. It was unfortunately videotaped by a helicopter. So you watch number 5 and 6 break out of the Delta, and number 6 actually went way out of the Delta to reformat. And it was shortly thereafter that the Thunderbirds said that they were going to stand down as far as these flyovers go, because all three teams had a high-risk event. Unfortunately, the loss of the Thunderbird, unfortunately, the loss of the Snowbird, you know, the near miss of the Thunderbirds in their Delta formation and the miscalculation on the turn. And last but not least, my least favorite event was the almost interaction of a drone over Detroit with the Blue Angels. So I think all three teams, it came to the conclusion that it was time to stand down.
I think it was a good call. I mean, it was a nice gesture to have done, but you're right. There are just enough operational problems where you say, you know what, this is not what we do from a routine standpoint. Anytime you start doing things that are not part of your normal routine, you're not going to be as good at it, and you're more likely to have issues. So yeah, why keep going and hoping and praying that nothing bad is eventually going to happen when you've already had a couple signs that bad things could happen? So yeah, I think this is the right move. Let's get those people out of the air. They did a really nice thing and let them get back to the basics of what they're paid to do.
And the logistics involved are not necessarily what the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds do. They aren't designed to fly Delta formations for long periods of time. And involved with that also was events like tanking, air-to-air refueling. They were flying these missions, and they were long-duration missions. I mean, and multiple tanking. There were interacting with air traffic control, Delta formations, and because if you watch their normal demonstration, they're in the Delta formation for maybe 10 minutes out of a 30-minute thing. Flying 6 inches from wingtip to cockpit is very stressful work. Yeah, they're really good at what they do, all three teams, but eventually something's going to give because of being tired. So thankfully, unfortunately, we lost someone, but thankfully, common sense prevailed. And the other interesting fact was it was causing more, a lot of the times over the major areas. I know here when we had the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds do the flyover here in Philadelphia, there were hundreds of people without any masks within multiple feet of each other, causing possible spread of the virus, which wasn't the intention, but one of those unintended consequences.
Yeah.
So, I mean, thank you to all three teams, but I guess it was the best thing to happen.
I agree. And the other thing that to add to what David said, keep in mind that when they do their performances, they're up for whatever, 30 minutes, 40 minutes. Then they land right there. This is the equivalent of doing your performance. And now we're going to spend 2 hours heading home and we're going to tank up on our way home without a break. And we probably spent an hour to 2 hours getting to where we were going to do that.
Yeah. Gives me a headache just thinking about it. Yeah. There's no point that we should be exhausting these men and women doing stuff that they're, you know, not normally doing. So, yep, it was great. They did it. Glad it's done.
So another thing that the Air Force is doing apparently is adjusting the height requirement for pilot applicants. I guess they're trying to achieve some greater diversity in their pilot population.
Yeah, they're letting a 6'4" people fly, jokingly.
And what good does that do you and me now?
Well, this actually has been a good thing. And it's primarily, like you said, to promote diversity. A lot of women didn't meet the height requirements to fly aircraft.
So we should say what those were, right? The medical standards directory requirement had previously required pilot applicants to be between 5'4" and 6'5".
It's primarily given the lowering the thing so that 5'3" women or men, smaller men can fly aircraft. It was always because of the ejection seats that the height requirement was there, but now they're broadening it out so that we can have more diversity, more women can apply for flight time. And smaller people. I don't see any 6'6" people or taller, 8 foot people, or your average run of the mill basketball player applying to fly a jet fighter. It's cramped to begin with when you're 6'4", 6'5". So this is a really good thing. It's the Air Force thinking beyond, that regulation needed to go. We can make ejection seats now that are capable of height restrictions. The only issue was originally it was a lot of the height restrictions were based on weight, that people who were smaller were too light for the ejection seats. Ejection seat technology has come to the point now where that's not necessarily a factor anymore. So anybody out there who's 5'2", eyes of blue, go for it. We need more pilots, and that's another reason we need more pilots.
Now I'm thinking, David, you said people who were too light. So I guess the problem was that when you have smaller mass in there, it's going to be accelerated greater. The pilot's going to pull more G's and it's going to be bad for them.
Yes. And there was more risk of them being not handling the ejection itself,
In the early ejection seats, in fact, if you were below weight because you weren't flying with all your combat gear, they would actually put weights in the bottom of the seat.
Well, the Air Force has said that the previous screening criteria eliminated about 44% of American women between the age of 20 and 29. So there's where you get a bias in your diversity. But the Air Force Times also said, and this is kind of interesting, that instead of a blanket height requirement, because you got to ask, okay, so if they're not going to do that, what are they going to do instead? It says the Air Force said that it will apply an anthropometric screening process to figure out which specific aircraft applicants would be able to fly. These measurements, says, in addition to standing height, also measure an applicant's eye height while sitting, buttocks to knee length, and arm span, and are entered into a computer to determine which aircraft the applicant could and could not safely fit in. That kind of makes a lot of sense to me.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Totally cool.
All right. Well, we've got a couple of pre-recorded items for you. And first up, we have Launchpad's conversation with Martin Tuck from Textron Aviation. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, he's the technical marketing specialist in Beech and Cessna aircraft products. And the two of them talk about the new Cessna Sky Courier, which we've mentioned a couple of times on a couple of episodes. But this is a really interesting look into that airplane. And let's play that right now.
Hello, airplane geeks. It's your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari.
And I've got a special guest today. I'm here with
Martin Tuck, Textron Aviation in Wichita, Kansas.
And Mr. Tuck is here to talk to us today about an airplane I'm really excited about because it's a brand new airplane. And I just think it's cooler than heck. It's the new Cessna SkyCarrier. And you just had a first flight of this airplane, didn't you?
Yeah, May the 17th at around 9:15 in the morning. It was a wonderful, beautiful Sunday morning, and did about 2.25 hours flying time, and very successful.
Now, what sets this airplane apart? And we're going to have some graphics for you in the show notes. It's a high-engine twin. It's kind of boxy looking. And at first, it doesn't look very sexy, but what it does is extremely cool. It's a cargo carrier that holds 3 palletized L3 pallets. Tell us why you built this airplane, Martin.
Well, we actually built the aircraft. We've been looking at we have a number of operators that operate the Caravan. They operated in a sort of a cargo role. It's called the Cargo Master. And one of those operators came to us and said, you know, that the volume of freight that we're having to carry these days with e-commerce, the way it is, that we need a much bigger aircraft, one that's capable of carrying 3 pre-sorted LD3 containers. These are the containers that fit typically in the lower half of the larger container cargo-type aircraft. And so basically, we lined up 3 LD3s and designed the aircraft around it. And one of the requirements was to have a twin-engined aircraft for safety and reliability. But also, the request was to just keep it as simple as we could, make it robust, and out of that will come good reliability. And that's what we've done.
And listeners, I want to explain 2 quick things. You heard me refer to it as a pallet. This is not your standard 4-foot by 4-foot wooden pallet like you see down at Lowe's. Think of it more along the lines of an aluminum box that's, you know, 60 inches deep, 64 inches tall, and about 60 inches wide at its widest point. It's a big aluminum box that you've seen on the tarmac and runways being loaded in, and we'll have a picture of it. And the fact that it's palletized load is just super significant. In a previous life, many of us have had to deal with palletization, and having to hand load an airplane like a Cessna Caravan and put each individual box in is labor intensive. Then you have to unload the airplane, which is also labor intensive. But not only that, it's not just loading and unloading the airplane. It's for like customers like FedEx. You go to an outlier airport like Lubbock or Midland, Texas. You load the Cessna 208. You fly it to Dallas. Then you offload it. Then you put everything into a different pallet and ship it to Memphis, where they're going to break that pallet apart, resort it, rebuild the pallet, ship it out to you. Then you got to break the pallet apart again to put it back on the airplane. And now they can just build the pallet at Memphis, and it goes and put a big sticker on it that says send to Midland. And so suddenly all at Dallas, they go there, they pull the pallet out, and they just run it with their little pallet loader over to this new Cessna SkyCarrier. And they load one for Midland, one for, you know, I don't know, Odessa or Lubbock, and the plane makes a 3 little circuit round. Having had to break pallets down in a previous life for reorganizing pallets is a big deal. And this is an exciting aircraft because it holds 3 pallets, correct?
That's correct, yes. And of course, you know, how we get them on the aircraft is even more interesting because these, as you say, these pallets are bigger, they're more containers, really, they're called. And so we have a big 7-foot wide by almost 6 feet tall door on the side of the fuselage, the rear end of the fuselage there into which you then load those pallets. They then slide up the fuselage and we can very quickly put on 3. So along with the pressure refueling, the aircraft can be on its way within probably 10, 15 minutes of arriving.
We're going to come back to pressure refueling for a second. why do a side load and not a tail load?
Well, a lot of that design configuration was actually dictated to by our launch customer. So they actually wanted to have that side load capability, and that's what we've designed.
Okay, that's as good as, you know, if that's the way they want it, sure enough. It was just you. I was thinking you'd want to just roll them right out the back, but this will let you get a forklift right up or a load device right up next to it.
That's correct.
Yeah, the door is huge. Is the aircraft pressurized?
No, it's an unpressurized aircraft.
But the door is load bearing then, because it's that it's a huge part of the skin of the aircraft.
It is. If you have a picture of it there, you can see that it's actually a very large, as I say, it's a very large door, and it is a structural member of the fuselage, yes.
For our geek listeners, talk to us about the cool advantage of single-point pressure fueling.
So this aircraft, you know, once you see it, actually, it is a very big aircraft. It's a 72-foot wingspan. Its tail height is around 20 feet. And the wings themselves are up really high, more than around 11 to 12 feet in the air. And so to refuel it, you'd have to go on a very long ladder and you know, gravity refuel the aircraft. So we've actually put a pressure refueling port on the right-hand nacelle on the underside. And so it's very much easier to hook up a tanker and just pressure refuel the aircraft in, I think it's around 5 minutes to pressure refuel the aircraft. The wings are a wet wing design, so the fuel goes straight into the wing tanks.
And again, this pressure refueling, this is the same standardized nozzle system that, if you will, the big boys take.
It's a universal adapter, yes.
Unlike with a 208, where you're using a ladder and what looks like a gas, you know, standard.
Yeah, that's gravity refueling. Yeah, the gravity refueling system.
Exactly. So what we've got is, even though it's compared to the other cargo airplanes on the ramp, a small airplane that can play in the big boys arena. It handles palletized cargo. It takes pressurized fuel, non-retractable. So there's a simplicity. I'm looking at the gate at the instruments. And you're using, it looks like the panel will be the exact same panel that's in a Cessna 208.
Well, pretty much. You know, we're using the same Garmin G1000 NXI. That's the NXI that has the high-definition screens. Originally, when we put the 10-inch screens, which are on the Caravan, into this aircraft, they looked a bit on the small side. So we're actually putting the 12-inch displays in, which make for a very much better fit, and that also allows for both engines then to be a full dial indication to be displayed on the multifunction display, which is in the center.
But by staying with the G1000, that means upgrading your pilots from the customer pilots from a 208 Caravan to a 408, the buttonology stays the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the transition is very easy. It's just a bigger display. The actual the way the system works, it's actually slightly easier because we do have a keypad this time as well, so which the Caravan doesn't. So there's in terms of inputting numbers and letters, you can very easily put that in through the keypad.
And this is going to be certified single pilot?
It will be certified single pilot. Yes, that's correct.
Now, to our listeners, I want to point out that FedEx is your launch customer, and they've ordered 50. Let's put that in perspective. They own 200 Caravans right now, and to take a bet on a quarter of their fleet is a pretty significant bet, and they must have great confidence in Cessna's ability to deliver this aircraft.
Yes, there's 50 firm orders, and they have a 50 options as well. So that gives them a total of potentially 100 initially aircraft. And really, they're going to be used to supplement their fleet. They're going to be running the Caravans on those kind of trips where the Caravan makes sense, and then flying the Sky Courier as a feeder alongside the Caravans.
The Caravan will hold, or excuse me, the Courier according to the website, will hold 6,000 pounds of cargo. So that quick math says that's 3 1-ton containers. That's a lot of packages. That's some impressive weight.
Yeah, that's the freighter payload, 6,000 pounds. And you're quite right. That's potentially 2,000 pounds in each of those containers. You can actually have more in the center container just because that's where the CG envelope allows that. But essentially, it does allow 3 2,000-pound containers.
So that means the floor is going to have to be fairly robust, if not reinforced. Is there going to be a roller system on the floor?
Well, we actually have an optional roller system that a company called Ankara, they're very probably familiar with that. They develop a lot of those cargo handling systems, and that will be available as an option for this aircraft.
All right, that's pretty cool. Okay, going back to the test, your first flight aircraft, one of the things that I noticed is that on both engines, the port exhaust port of the PT-6 is pointed up, while the starboard exhaust is pointed straight, which when you looked at the starboard engine meant that, you know, okay, that makes sense. They must, you know, route it up over the wing to get it out from the, you know, side of the fuselage. But then on the port wing, the starboard nacelle points directly, or the starboard exhaust points at the fuselage. What's going on there?
Well, the this is we're on a very short timeline here, and so to get prototype into the air as quickly as possible, we used a couple of standard -65 power plants from Pratt & Whitney Canada, and we did notice, of course, with the configuration that we have with that nacelle just below the center line of the cord of the wing, that there was potential to heat the wing up with the exhaust, and so we decided to sort of tilt up the left-hand side so the prop wash would allow the hot exhaust gases to go over the top of the wing and avoid heating it up. And then, of course, you know, it's not an issue on the other side because the prop wash will naturally take the hot exhaust away from the wing.
Uh-huh.
The engines are currently now we've got the actual engines will be the exhaust stacks will actually, one of the exhaust stacks will be located at a 45-degree angle. And so it'll still be kind of allowing the exhaust to go over the wing, but it won't look so kind of odd, if you see what I mean.
Well, sir, thank you for taking the time. I'm just excited about the fact that we're seeing a brand new airplane and that the airplane is so intelligently designed to meet a very specific mission.
Well, I think so too. And, you know, we're also developing the passenger variants as well. So we'll have a common airframe that will allow both freight. And then if then the other airframe will add windows and emergency exits. And that'll be available for a short passenger configured aircraft, up to 19 seats.
And I take it in the growth path, there'll be probably some special door or a different door configuration?
Well, actually, we involved a number of operators that operate that type of aircraft, and they like the idea of being able to have a quick change interior such that they could take out the seats, which they may fly during the day, and then haul freight at night. And so we actually took their advice, and we kept the same large cargo door. Now, we'll have fold down steps, which will allow passengers to enter the aircraft through that door. But it does allow, you know, the width of the door does allow the passengers to enter while the baggage is being loaded at the back too.
Thank you for taking the time to speak to our listeners. And if they wanted to know more about the Cessna SkyCarrier, where would they go?
They would go to our website, which is Cessna.com or TXTAV.com.
Thank you for taking the time, sir. This is Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
All right. That was a great conversation.
Thank you. As you can tell, I got excited about the fact that it was a brand new airplane.
Yeah.
Some positive news.
Yeah.
very, very, very cool. I've always been excited about this guy Courier, but I learned so much about it, and I'm even more excited about it now. I think, you know, as an engineer, I've just always loved things that are purpose-built and do something extremely well. Yes. And you know, clearly this is something that's going to be just a super, super, super cargo aircraft, and cool that they're going to be able to also, you know, put the seats in the daytime. I could just imagine, you know, FedEx planes that fly into Las Vegas, you know, in the daytime they're flying Grand Canyon tours. And at night they're flying cargo or something crazy like that.
All I could think of was this is going to be a huge sales for skydiving team.
If they can open up that door,
you know, you can get 10 or 15 people in that aircraft and throw open the door. That's
we talked about that off mic. And what it'll be is, no, they won't. You can't open that door. So think of a passenger or an open jump door that's contained inside the bigger door. But still, it'll make a good jump aircraft.
Now, I didn't fully understand the exhaust over the wing. I was kind of joking here in the notes and said, hey, maybe it's for anti-icing. But why is it that the exhaust goes one way and goes the other? And what's the benefit of that?
They were doing some testing, and I totally forgot about prop wash in it. And if you look at it, the starboard engine looked like they were routing the exhaust over the wing to keep it from going down the side of the aircraft.
Okay.
But then when you looked at the port engine was pointed straight down the, quote, tunnel between the nacelle and the exhaust. And apparently the way the propeller prop wash will take care of that, so it's not going to be a heated zone.
Hmm.
And it was like, oh, okay, but they... You know, I expected it to be more symmetric, and they're not. They're one's pointed one way, and the other one's pointed the other way. And I was like, oh, wait, what's going on? And you can see it when you look nose on at the prototype one.
The thing that really impressed me about this airplane that really wasn't brought up is something all the accountants at all the airlines are going to be thinking about, and that's utilization. I mean, really what you've set up here is an extremely fast turn aircraft. Instead of spending an hour loading it, you're going to spend 10 minutes, you know, 15 minutes loading and unloading it. And when you do that, what that really means is you're going to get an extra flight a day out of it. Instead of flying, you know, two legs at night, now they can make it fly, you know, three legs. It's a little bit faster. But, you know, that's the thing about airplanes. Often for many aircraft, the utilization rate is low. And if you can just figure out ways to get faster turns, you can get more legs out of it, which means that, you know, that extra leg comes almost for free. And that's just part of the economics of, you know, how do you make an airline more profitable?
And you pass the work on to your local hub. So you land, you know, off goes the pallet for you know, City A. Back in the air to City B. Off goes the pallet for B. You land at C. Off goes their pallet. Okay, C, hand me the pallet you've been prepping. And then I reverse it. I go to B, give me your pallet. You know, A, give me your pallet. Okay, now I'm going to the hub. And rather than having to pack and unpack the airplane, you can just like, here you go. Give me your other pallet.
Yeah, I bet they could get probably close to twice as many hours a day out of these aircraft as they could out of the caravans.
Yeah. And that's the name of the game in the package delivery business, right? It's these kinds of efficiencies that allow 1 and 2 day delivery after order.
Should we be buying stock in the company that makes L3D pallets?
Yeah, well, I've been saying for a couple of years that I think that, you know, investments in package delivery companies might be a good play. And it seems to be even more so these days.
I want to thank Cessna for making Martin available to us.
Yes, yes. It was,
they went out of their way to get that interview with me.
Yes,
thanks. Or let me have that interview.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. My name is Mike Smith, and I have the honor of being the current president of the Experimental Aircraft Association, Chapter 196 in Stowe, Massachusetts. The epicenter of our chapter is the Minuteman Airfield, 6 Bravo 6, and its 3,000-foot paved runway, 1,700-foot grass runway, and 75 based aircraft. It has a flight school, an aviation maintenance academy, an on-field restaurant, Nancy's Airfield Cafe, it's on the Eat at the Airport page, and a test facility for a new hydrogen fuel cell urban mobility vehicle, the Sky by Alakai Technologies. What we also have is a wonderful youth program we're proud of, and since you've been discussing youth in aviation, I'd like to tell you about our programs. A large number of our members participate in the chapter primarily so they can fly young eagles. Launched in 1992, the EAA Young Eagles program has dedicated more than 25 years to giving youth ages 8 to 17 their first free ride in an airplane. Some kids simply take the ride and take in the cockpit and the scenery. If sitting in the right seat, many kids are game to take the controls and actually fly the airplane. They get to fly as much or as little as they would like, making turns, climbs, descents, and power changes. Sometimes we're able to find their home and fly over their house. At the end of the flight, they get a logbook of their flight, a flight certificate suitable for framing, and a web link to a free Sporty's ground school course. Last year, we flew 277 Young Eagles, and in the last 4 years, our members have flown 876 Young Eagles. We do this by scheduling Young Eagles flights once a month from April through November. With the weather being what it is, sometimes we get to fly, sometimes not. Young Eagles flights are first come, first served, and it doesn't matter if they've flown a Young Eagles flight before. Kids can take as many flights as they show up for. We have a number of repeat offenders we can count on seeing nearly every month. At least two of our past Young Eagles are now private pilots and flying Young Eagles themselves. We have two more in the pipeline that are working on their private pilot certificates. Unfortunately, we have not been able to fly any kids this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But as soon as it is safe to do so, you can be sure we'll be at it again. We've also been honored to be one of the first EAA chapters to award a Ray Aviation Scholarship to a young chapter member. In 2019, EAA began administering the Ray Aviation Scholarship, and our chapter was one of the lucky chapters selected to award a scholarship. The scholarship covers up to $10,000 of primary flight training for a young man or woman aged 16 to 19 for a powered aircraft, or a minimum age of 15 for glider training. Our first candidate has been a success and is nearly finished with her flight training. Notice I said her. Getting more women into aviation is a core mission of our chapter. With the success of our first candidate, we were granted the opportunity to award a second scholarship to another youngster in 2020. We have applied for a high school's teenager in our chapter and expect to be awarded the scholarship this summer. By now, I think you will understand our chapter's commitment to youth in aviation, but it doesn't stop there. We are all too aware that at any pilot gathering, the majority of who you see are a bunch of old guys. We have striven to try to move the needle in the other direction, looking to include as many women and young girls and boys as we can. We do this through outreach at local events such as Wings and Wheels, a weekly car and airplane open house and barbecue during the summer. Kids on the Fence. We take every opportunity when we see a kid hanging out looking through the airport fence to invite them and their family to come inside and look at and sit in our aircraft. It's a great time to spark an early interest in flight and tell them about all the youth activities we have. Stow Fest. That's an annual local spring event showcasing local groups and activities. We always show up with aviation videos, paper airplane making supplies, and information about our chapter and its events. We reach hundreds of families every spring. Open House and 5K Run the Runway. We hold an annual airport open house, kicking the day off with a 5K Run the Runway event, where local runners get to run the race by looping around the paved taxiway and runway. This introduces our airport to a large number of people who would otherwise not even know it exists. All proceeds go to the local Environmental Conservation Trust. Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and Scouts. We host a number of events during the year targeted at these two groups. We run them as an expanded Young Eagles event where they not only get to fly, but we also offer them a basic ground school and barbecue. We have one special young lady, Jada, who I really have to tell you about. At 12 years old, she has been taking Young Eagles flights for the past 2.5 years. In fact, she takes every opportunity to fly any airplane she can. She has already flown in more aircraft types than many private pilots. Hold on to your hats while I run through this list. Home-built Sonics, that's tied for her favorite, and that's my airplane. Home-built Vans RV4, that's the other tie for first place favorite. Home-built Vans RV6. N3N-3 biplane by Naval Aircraft Factory, similar to a Stearman. Fairchild 24W46, Boeing PT-18, Grumman Cheetah, Piper PA-28-140 Cherokee, Piper Cub Floatplane, Piper Cub PA-11 Special, Piper Warrior J3C-65, Piper PA-28-180, Piper PA-28-181, Piper J3 Cub. In fact, she and her pilot Alex won a bomb drop and wheel spot landing contest that day. Beechcraft Twin Engine Travel Air, Beechcraft Bonanza, Aranca 7AC, Champion Citabria, a Zenith, Blanca 85972, and Cessna 152, 170A, 172M, 177B, and 182s. Whew. And she doesn't just fly in these aircraft, she takes the controls and flies them. During our open house, Jada did a lot of the planning and execution of the kids' activities and created name tags for herself and her kid assistants that had "Ask a Kid Pilot" emblazoned across the top. So do you think aviation has reached this young lady? And finally, each year we use the funds we have raised to send at least one local kid to the week-long EAA Air Academy in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. There, kids spend a week in total aviation immersion, getting to build a wing rib, spend time in flight simulators, get a tour of various aircraft, a tour of the fabulous EAA Museum, to fly in both an airplane and a helicopter, and generally geeking out with the other young aviators, all in a summer camp atmosphere complete with bunk beds and cafeteria. In fact, Jada was supposed to go this summer, but because of COVID-19, that had to be postponed until next year. Our youth really are our future, and we are doing our best to help it make it a bright future.
Very good. Thanks, Mike.
To extend upon that, if you want to take your young eagles and find out how they can go for a flight and get them excited about aviation, go to eaa.org, and about the sixth tab over, it says youth, and you can click on that, and it'll tell you everything you need to do to get involved with this. My local EAA chapter, we do it with the high schools, and it's a culmination, but every chapter runs theirs a little different, and there's a chapter near you that'll let you take your expiring young eagles out for a ride.
Very good. I hope Zeke is listening. Maybe, Zeke, this is something that you could get involved in as a way to get yourself up in the air doing a little bit of flying.
In Launchpad, rather than Young Eagles, you and I could start the Bald Eagles, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that would work. All right. What's up with the geeks? Is anything up with anybody? Max West.
Well, let's see. It's been a fun day for me. I actually returned to the old flight school today, and I looked it up. 83 days since I was last doing anything there. So that was pretty wild. And prior to going there, since I knew I was going to be teaching the simulator, I knew that we were going to be required to wear masks. I was thinking, you know, that massive Santa Claus beard that I've been growing for the past 81 days, because I did shave the first 1 or 2 days I was home, was probably going to interfere with the mask somewhat. And I thought, you know, it's probably a good, you know, virus catcher. You know, it's like, yeah. Do you really, I mean, the masks aren't going to fit as well and so on. So in anticipation of this, I didn't have any kind of hair clippers. And so I ordered something from Amazon that came on, Sunday. So very, very recently. Here it is. I read the box here. It says,
Radio, Max. Radio. We can't see the box. No,
that's why I'm going to read it. Yeah, exactly. It says Professional Hair Clipper, model LA-M938. Bought this on Amazon, and it's got all the little blades, and I read some of the hundreds of reviews that basically said, oh, yeah, this is great. Use this for my hair. My wife did, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I thought, okay, it's fine. So I took the thing out and shaved the beard off. Worked really great. And I hadn't seen the manual when I was you know, pulling it out. And then after I finished up, was all done, I noticed the manual was in there, you know, a place where I hadn't looked before. So I started reading through it to see, you know, what did I miss? And I read through it, and let me just quote what the manual here says. Item number one, determine the hair length of your pet that needs to be shaved.
Oh,
that one I didn't expect.
I, honest to goodness, I laughed for a solid minute. I was hysterical. I just thought, you know, with all of the absurdity and all of the inconveniences and all the unexpected things that we've had with a pandemic, you know, it just, I just thought it was hysterical because, you know, I'm guessing this is not really intended for pets. So this is just a, you know, a manual, you know, screw up because they are selling it for people.
Yeah.
But that's what they're telling you now.
Yeah. Well, certainly all the reviewers were talking about them, not their their pets. But I was just hysterical afterwards. this is just perfect. But anyway, I've got just the mustache here. I'm kind of sporting the Captain Jeff here look for now. So what do you think?
It is kind of a Captain Jeff look. It's not long enough to require mustache wax like Launchpad.
Well, anyway, it's been a fun day. It was fun to go do the little simulator training today, and it was just hilarious to remove this beard.
Very good.
All right. Oh, there he is. So yeah, you can't see it because this is radio, as Launchpad says, but he's holding up his little tin of, I assume that's mustache wax.
That is.
Yeah, I wish I could do that.
And it says clearly on it, not for pet use.
Oh, sure it does. Yeah.
So, yeah, my recent activity is also not aviation related or as strictly aviation related. I went off-grid camping last week, which is why we didn't do any UAV digest last week because there was no cell phone coverage. So a few times I could pick up one bar, if I was up at higher altitudes and could check.
Your arms were longer.
Held that phone up in the air, check for any text messages that were queued up. But basically I was totally off grid. So it was actually very nice not to do any of the usual things that we do online. I also had no idea of the news. I was in Pennsylvania up in the mountains, and I didn't know that they'd caught that kid from UConn that was wanted for some murders who was last seen in Pennsylvania as well. And I didn't see anything about the rioting and things that have been going on as we record this. So it was kind of a shocker to come back to the news. But it was kind of nice to be completely unplugged for 4 days.
That's nice. Where in Pennsylvania were you? What towns were nearby?
I was in Bald Eagle State Forest.
Of course, yeah. I know it.
Yeah.
That's south of where I grew up.
Launchpad, anything going on lately with you?
I've been up flying, and both with an instructor and with my son, we went up and we've been practicing commercial maneuvers, trying to get ready to take my commercial pilot's exam. So we've been up doing chandelles and 360 spirals and 360 levels, and we're trying to do it all in my airplane. So, you know, A, because I own one, and B, that's what I want to take the test in. So let's practice in the plane we're going to test in. But that's what I've been doing. I've been up doing chandelles, and I haven't gotten to Lazy H yet because, boy, you got to do those way down low. And I'm like, not used to flying that airplane under, 1,500 feet, except for when I'm in the pattern.
Well, you don't have to do lazy eights down low. You'd have to do eights on pylons down low. So that might be it. And Launchpad, let me just call out for you. Two episodes ago, Aviation News Talk, episode 149. Have you heard it?
Yes, I have. I was setting you up for this.
Oh, yes. How to really fly commercial certificate maneuvers. So that's good. I hope you found that helpful.
I did.
All right. A quick shout out. This came in from our main man, Micah. This is the last B-24. Now, there is a program on PBS that documents this. It's about a 1 hour, a little bit less than that, program that you can watch online. It's the story of the last B-24 that came off the assembly line during World War II, which crashed into the Mediterranean. It was rediscovered, and now there was an effort to locate the plane, but also search for the remains of the servicemen who lost their lives so they could be brought back to their families. So I think this actually premiered in late 2018, but it is available on the PBS website. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, and you can watch the program there. All right, on to some listener mail. We have a huge backlog of listener mail, and I think we have more teed up here than we'll have time to get to this episode, so we may have to defer some of this. I think we'll certainly will, but we got an email from Carrie who said wanted to add some context to the comment Max West made about getting the commercial certificate. While I agree completely that every rating improves one's flying skills, the commercial rating requires a second-class physical. Speaking from experience, be sure to fully understand the requirements for the increased physical before taking the medical. For me, my vision is correctable to 20/20, and the AME signed me off for the second-class medical. For a specific reason I don't remember, the FAA sent me a, quote, cease and desist order, nullifying my physical and grounding me. They required me to go to a specialist for additional testing who did sign off on their requirements. Because when a higher level physical is rejected, one cannot default to the lower level, which doesn't have that same requirement. Carrie finishes, bottom line, as I had no real intention to fly commercially, the frustration caused me to even stop pursuing the commercial rating.
And I sent a reply to him, and he replied back to me. I said, Carrie, I'm sorry you went through all that trouble. You only need a second-class medical if you're planning to use a commercial certificate. For the check ride, all you need is a third-class medical or even basic med these days. So if you'd like to pursue your commercial, any medical you have will be fine for the check ride. And I can't remember when I did mine over 20 years ago. It may have been the case back then that you had to have a second class to take the check ride. I just can't recall. But that has not been the case for some years. Anyway, he said in reply that that was not how it had been explained to him by his instructor. He said that his hematologist was not happy about the additional paperwork because the cease and desist order was regarding a blood disease that he reported years later. And here's the sad part. He said that on December 2001, I sold my Mooney and walked away from flying after accumulating 1,300 hours. So, Carrie, so sorry that you felt that you had to give up flying at that point, but I can understand for some medical issues, it can take a heck of a lot of time and expense to work through them.
All right. Thanks for that, Max. And we heard from our friend Jamie Dodson, and we talked about the documentary film on Pan Am, Across the Pacific, and it's now able to be watched online. The first episode of the Pan Am documentary is entitled Airborne, and it's streaming on the website of Virginia Public Media, which is the presenting PBS station, but you can watch it online, and we'll have a link in the show notes where you can view that. And Jamie also notes that the two subsequent episodes, Latin Laboratory and Another Ocean, will be available online through PBS on May 29th, which has happened already, and June 5th, which is just about now, respectively. And John wrote in, said, recently I've been watching YouTube videos on the P-38 in the Pacific during World War II. He says there's a conversation about how Lindbergh advised the pilots to get longer range regarding fuel management. John says, as I understand it, Lindbergh recommended reducing RPM to 16 to 1800, keeping manifold pressure around 22 inches. The results were significant, apparently. John says, however, in my United States Air Force flying and general aviation, I have not heard it discussed. I'm hoping some of you may have some thoughts on this.
No question. With piston engines in particular, there are all kinds of things that you can do to increase the range, one of which, of course, would be to go at lower fuel settings, another which is to go at lower RPM settings. And so to get a given level of power, you can sometimes choose if for 75% power, for example, do I want to have a higher manifold pressure and lower RPM or vice versa? And the combination that really helps you out is the one that's lower RPM. and higher manifold pressure, because you're going to get internal, lower internal friction in the engine if it's, you know, turning over perhaps, you know, 10% fewer RPMs, and that's going to help with efficiency. I'm trying to think what else. Certainly leaning. There are ways that you can run engines lean of peak versus rich of peak. And, you know, for years, most engines were run rich of peak. So, and you, of course, don't see a whole lot of this. You mentioned in U.S. Air Force flying, you don't have the same kind of range of, you know, leaning options available to you, if you will, with jets. Yes, you can get some longer range by throttling back, but not nearly percentage-wise as much as you can with a piston engine.
And to put that in perspective for some of the our other listeners, in a P-38, we're talking about an aircraft that in what was considered normal flight would be closer to 2,200 RPM. And at full anger, they would push probably close to 28 to maybe 3,000 RPM at 50 inches of manifold pressure. Of course, at that range, they're consuming 50 gallons of gas per engine per hour. So that's why you start really raking it back.
Wow. You know, longtime listener Mark Newton might be one of the most interesting guys I've never met. And he wrote to us recently and said that on Sunday, May 17th, he says, my RV formation team landed in foreship on runway 16 right at Sydney International. Whoa. He says, with the global coronavirus-driven decline of airline activity, our two-seat single-engine airplanes very briefly made Sydney the busiest airport in Australia. That's pretty good. So there's a video that they made of the arrival shot from ship number 4, and we'll have that link in the show notes. Also, a forum post on Vans Air Force, notes that we think we might have become the first civilian formation to land at Sydney's big airport, although it's very old, so we might be wrong about that. But we know we're the first formation of home built, so we're going to claim that record, which is cool. And then, there's some great air to air photos in these links, and you want to check them up or check them out. But also in a follow up email, Mark noted that Sydney Airport released their own video of the visit of these aircraft. And so that's a really great video, and we'll have that link in the show notes as well.
And I salute you guys because, yeah, I flew into DFW, but I couldn't get my camera to work, and all I could do was a touch and go, or low pass, I mean. You guys got the land, so I salute you. What a great idea.
Very cool. Yeah, check that stuff out.
And I'd like to give a quick shout out to Mark. I did meet him when I was in Australia 2 years ago. That's and great. He came down to visit me at Orange Regional Airport when I was teaching there. And, you know, I really felt bad at the time because I was in the midst of teaching. And, you know, he walked up to say hello. And I wasn't really in a position where I could kind of walk away from the client who I'm, you know, being paid to teach at that moment. He was very gracious about the whole thing, and I felt bad about it. But what a nice guy. What a beautiful RV. Enjoyed seeing him fly that down there at Orange Regional. Had a wonderful time in Australia. I just love the people in that country. I can't wait to go back.
Yeah. I've never met an Australian I didn't like. Trevor writes in, first of all, I really think I like the idea of an airplane geeks for kids. Something that's been sort of tossed around in the back of my head. He said it would really get the kids listening here kind of, quote, their own language. I also think I should make a change for the records. Now, Trevor says, I am 11 years old, born in July 2008, surpassing Zeke as the youngest member. You are reaching out to the younger people, which is very, very cool. So, yeah, it seems that Trevor now holds the record as our youngest regular listener, which is quite an honor, I think. Sorry, Zeke, you held the spot for a little while, but looks like you've been surpassed.
Go, Trevor!
Yeah, that's very cool.
Nice to hear from him.
He doesn't even remember the 20th century.
You didn't miss much, Trevor.
Peter wrote in with a couple of questions. So one of them was asking about Chris Mano's book. Chris was our guest in episode 602. And Peter writes, I was really impressed by his life story. Would like to read his book. Do you have any information if his book is or will be sold in paper copy and where to get it? And it turns out that Chris Mano's new book, An Airline Pilot's Life, is now available in paperback on Amazon.com. It was released on May 24th this year, 2020. Look for that, An Airline Pilot's Life on Amazon. And Peter writes and says he's actually got the book on order now.
And congratulations to Chris for his retirement, which was last week.
Yes, that's pretty exciting too. And then we heard from our longtime friend, Robert E. Coli, who says, hi, geeks. I hope you are all well and remaining distant. At Thrombey Air, we are doing our bit too. Now, you may remember Thrombey Air. Tagline is the lowest of the low. So they've got an item out there on their website, Social Distancing for Dummies. And he notes that airlines around the COVID world are trying to figure out how to restart flying safely, and everybody has a different idea. Social distancing works, but we'd hate our passengers to get used to having lots of room. They think they have a solution, which is a graphic that you have to see. Social distancing for dummies. If you are the least bit aware of Thrombey Air, you're going to jump right out to the show notes to get to the link for this. But it's at thrombeyair.com. And take a look at that. Always good for a laugh from Thrombey Air. All right, with that, we'll wrap up this episode. I want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Thanks for all the great feedback we've gotten. I know we have some more that we'll try to get to next episode. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Look for our show notes there. If you want to go straight to the show notes, visit airplanegeeks.com/606. 606, and it will redirect you right to the show notes for this episode. All right, Max Trescott, where do we find you online?
At the usual place, coming out to aviationnewstalk.com. Also check out the Aviation News Talk podcast, wherever you get your podcast. And I would also say, be aware of hair clippers, you know, unless you're clipping your pet.
I need some hair clippers. David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
I'm not shaving my beard. Just so you guys know, I had it before the rest of you, and you know, you're just followers. We're just going to leave it at that. But besides that, you can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on our Slack listener team. And you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we'll be happy to have you join the fun there. And of course, you can find me on that show on Fridays when he's not social distancing in the woods with that guy Max Flight on the UAV Digest.
Launchpad Marzari, where do we find you?
Well, I'm back on Facebook. If you search for Launchpad Marzari and click on the correct one. On Twitter, I'm Pilot Launchpad. And then again, I'm on our Slack listener team, as Dave just correctly pointed out, as Launchpad. Or you can email me directly at launchpad@theairplanegeeks.com.
Very good. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight, on LinkedIn, as David said, at theuavdigest.com, talking about unmanned aviation, and at paxxpodcast.com with Mary Kirby, talking about the passenger experience. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Frequency change approved.
And thanks for listening.
Okay.
At some later point, oh, who's ringing my doorbell now? Oh, this is more important than that. Why can't I teach the cat to answer the door?
It might be FedEx delivering something to you.
Yeah,